I'm glad everybody's going to be quiet now.
I'm calling the committee to order. The first bill on the list is Representative Mullery's House Bill 2610. Mr. Mullery, would you care to explain your bill and get it onto its way?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, this is the bill that we already had a long hearing on, I think an hour, explaining it.
And Mr. Mullery, I suspect your bill has probably been heard. Are there any questions to this bill?
Is there an amendment, Mr. Chair?
There is an amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right.
The A1 amendment.
Is this your amendment, Mr. Mullery?
I would move that, Mr. Chair.
All those, and this gets it in the shape that you want it in?
Yes.
We should do that. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Mr. Mullery, can you explain your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It just does four things that the prosecutors came up and said that they needed the first time changes, and so I adopted what they wanted on this. It just had the prior to the entry of a court order disposing with forfeiture action, the county attorney can make certain dispositions as far as mitigation, but that after a court order that can't be done. Second thing, it changed to the peace officer stand, the post board, the county attorneys, etc., the sheriffs, all would get together to do the guidelines on actions instead of DPS, which made complete sense to me. And the only other thing, it was very interesting. In order to make it fairer for the owner of the property, we have a limit on how long they have to take the action, the government, but if there is a criminal proceeding, then that's extended so that the criminal or the person possibly would not have to implicate themselves that could be used against them in the criminal, and then we took out the last section. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mullery, are there any questions on this particular bill? Any questions on this bill? Anyone care to testify against this bill, the chairman's bill? Anyone care to testify against the chairman's bill? Seeing none. All those in favor, Representative Mullery renews his motion for House File 2610 to be referred to the
Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
Public Safety Policy Bill, as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
You're on your way, Mr. Mullery.
Representative Bigham, Deb will move, I'm sorry, Representative Dolstrom will move House File 3187 on to the floor. This goes to the General Register, correct?
Yes.
Representative Bigham, go ahead with your bill, remembering that we have 26 bills on tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the accommodation. House File 3187 is a bill that deals with the civil commitment process, particularly the procedure for providing sworn statements in commitment cases and using for electronic records. It applies only to the civil commitment, not any other kind of court proceedings. The bill was drafted by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office in conjunction with representatives of a panel of attorneys in Hennepin County who represent respondents in commitment cases. It was reviewed by the Minnesota Disability Law Center, County Attorney Association, State Hospital Association, and the main hospitals that initiate most of our civil commitment processes. The court and court administration in Hennepin County and the Department of Health and Human Services. The bill does two things. It allows for documents to be treated as made under oath, without the need for a notary, if they contain a statement that they are made under the penalties of perjury. Second, it clarifies that the documents that are electronically signed as part of electronic record system, which are now being used in most hospitals, will be allowed as evidence in civil commitment cases. With me today is Mr. John Kerwin of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office to provide a little bit more of an explanation and technicalities of the bill.
Representative Bigham, I think we'll see if there's any opposition to it. We're not going to go into a lot of detail on bills tonight.
Okay.
Is there any opposition to this? Is there any opposition to this bill from anybody? Looks like not. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 3187, send it to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Does she have something else? Does she have another one? Or agree? Well, we don't have time now. Let's go on. Okay, Representative Jackson moves the minutes of Wednesday, March 3rd, and Monday, March 1st. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
What's next?
Representative Gardner, are you here? Representative Gardner, I will move your bill 1217 to pass without recommendation, and it goes to the General Register. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and I have an author's amendment.
Is this oral or is it out?
It's the A9 amendment. I passed it on last week. All it does, Mr. Chair, is deletes Section 1 on page 1. And amends the title accordingly.
Can you explain that?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if the amendment is in the packets, but you could just do it orally.
Okay,
delete Section 1 of the bill.
I will move for Representative Gardner to do oral amendment to delete Section 1. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair, and amend the title accordingly.
That's to get it in the shape the author wants, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Gardner, with that, we no longer have jurisdiction of the bill, and therefore I will renew my motion to send it without recommendation to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Mr. Chair.
Abler? Representative Abler? Does somebody want to move them?
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Where does this go?
Where does it go?
Representative Abler?
Representative Abler, does this go to the General Register?
Early childhood.
Where?
Early childhood finance.
Oh,
it goes to finance, and they'll send it to
early childhood. Representative Mahoney moves House File 3239 to pass and be referred to Finance Committee. Representative Abler, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Mahoney, for the motion. This is a good bill. I'll leave it to my witness to persuade you of that to save time.
Okay. Go ahead. State your name and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Laura Plummer-Zarest with the Department of Human Services Licensing Legal Office. It's my understanding that this committee would like me to address just sections 13 and 14. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
Section 13 and 14, yes.
I will do that then. Section 13 is in regard to license holder record keeping requirements, and this is pertaining to employers that are required to initiate background studies under our Human Services Background Studies Law, Chapter 245C. And the affected employers are required to initiate studies on certain persons that are specified in this law. And in order to minimize the need for duplicative background studies, the law also allows DHS to complete background studies that are initiated by agencies such as personnel, pool agencies, temporary pool agencies, educational programs. And this language would merely require an employee that exercises this option to maintain a copy of the individual's background study results in the license holder's files when they have the other agency complete that study. Section 14 is regarding classification of certain data. And under our background studies law, as well as the Data Practices Act, data pertaining to background studies is generally classified as private data. However, certain data related to disqualifications is classified specifically as public data, particularly that is data relating to a set-aside or a variance when the individual is affiliated with any child care program, or when that set-aside or variance is pertaining to a disqualification that is under a felony-level disqualification. Household members of a foster care provider are required to have a study under our background studies law. And this includes individuals who have been adopted by the foster care provider. So in order to address some concerns that have arisen about the identity of individuals who previously received foster care services from a licensed foster care provider possibly becoming public data, this amendment clarifies that data pertaining to the set-aside or granting of a variance relating to the disqualification of an individual who was a foster child and then was adopted is private data on that individual.
Okay.
Are there any questions regarding either of these sections?
Is there anybody testifying against this bill? Are there any questions from the members of the committee? Okay, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to pass House File 3239 and send it to re-refer it to finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Our representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom moves her bill 2613. I believe it goes to the general register, or does it go to finance?
It goes to finance, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, go ahead with your...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This House file 2613 is the homeowner lender mediation bill. This is the bill that we passed last year. Went to the governor. The governor vetoed it. We continue to work with the stakeholders on the issue, and we've been picking up some support, Mr. Chair, and I'd ask you to pass the bill again. You passed it last year.
Is there anybody opposed to this? We already heard it last year. Mr. Johnson, do you want to come down? I believe you're still opposed to it since you were opposed last week, but go ahead and probably an abbreviated version since we had an hour and a half last year on it.
Mr. Chairman, members, Steve Johnson with the Minnesota Bankers Association. We appreciate working with Representative Hillstrom and Attorney General and continuing to try to work out the issues. However, we do still have some concerns with it, the scope, and that the Attorney General appoints mediators have been a couple concerns we've had, and we've been working with them, and we do oppose it, but continue to work. So, and I just want to give a handout, too, if you wouldn't mind, just all the foreclosure bills we passed over the last couple of years. I just thought we'd pass this out for general information.
Thank you, Mr.
too.
Johnson. Yeah, so. At the last committee, you explained quite a few of them, but there's a page right there. Could you hand those out? It's a list of, and if you want to really quickly hit that, okay. I think everybody knows the issue. Is there anyone else opposed in the audience? Yes, Mr. Dunleavy. And state your name and if you're representing the real property section.
I'm not opposing the bill. I'm Kevin Dunleavy. I co-chair the legislative committee of the real property section. The Bar Association doesn't oppose or support the bill. We're essentially neutral because we've got attorneys that are both debtors' attorneys and creditors' attorneys. But I have a couple of technical concerns that need to be addressed, I believe. I emailed a number of technical concerns to the Attorney General's office but have not received a response. And the two main ones are that there has to be some way to prove up a five-week redemption period because that's not in anywhere in the statutory scheme right now. So there has to be a way to prove up the five-week redemption period. And the real property section has worked for many years to have uniform recording fees, and we only achieved that a couple of years ago after the recording fees were doubled. And so we're concerned about having a different recording fee for certain types of documents.
Do you have a specific proposal, or do you want to? I guess that my problem is, what are you asking right now? Is there a specific proposal, or do you want to work with them as it goes forward?
I'm happy to work with the Attorney General's office to try to address the problems. I don't think it's really not my job to figure out the funding for it, but I'm certainly willing to help with the technical problems.
Okay, so is there anybody else that wants to speak? Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, more to the point, because we are the ones that pass laws, is the author willing to work with the witness to kind of address those technical issues, not the money?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to work with whoever wants to work with me on the issues.
So. Okay. Thank you. And Representative Hillstrom in the AG's office, I hope you will work with them at least on the
technical legal problems, because I don't like to have a bill going out of this committee, which is the civil law committee, that isn't in the right shape as far as the legal language. So I guess we have a commitment, the author, and I hope the AG is going to work with the real property section, because we don't want things that don't work legally, as sometimes happens, and then we have to correct them the following year. So is there any discussion with the panel, with the members of the committee? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask, have the, and I don't have a copy of the veto letter from last year, but have the veto provisions or the provisions in the veto letter been addressed by the changes in the bill?
Is that Kermit, or state your full name and then answer.
Mr. Chair,
who you work for.
Mr. Chair, Kermit Fricke, I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Attorney General's Office. Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, it's my understanding that the authors are working with the governor's office on some of the issues that were raised in his veto letter. As of right now, the bill as it stands is exactly the same bill that was vetoed, that was passed by both houses. I have not been privy to any of those discussions, but I know that that's something that this both the Senate and the House author have been working on.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Okay. Then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass and send it to the Finance Committee. Is that correct? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
No.
It carries.
You.
Okay. Let's see. Representative Norton, do you have yours? Somebody want to move that?
Chair, I'll move Representative Norton's bill number.
Moves House File 3048.
3048.
Construction codes. Representative Norton, you've heard we're trying to move quickly, so
yep.
Only part of your bill, the last few pages plus the amendment that was put on, are in the realm of this committee. So if you could just address the civil parts, like the judgment,
absolutely.
The both
thank
parts
you,
of it.
We're going to be addressing, and there's a handout coming around that hopefully will help everyone, that's addressing sections 29 through 37 that are under this committee's jurisdiction. And just as a course of background, this is a bill that has been through both commerce committees. The bill deals with construction code, labor standards, and apprenticeships. And the department, this is a Department of Labor and Industry bill. It's has agreement to our knowledge, there's no opposition. It has agreement with the Builders Association, Pipe Trades, and others. So I can walk through the sections that are in the handout that you've just received if you'd like me to, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton, I was just told that the A-10-2255 amendment is supposed to go on this. Is that correct?
And I think we've been asked to not do that.
Not to do it. Okay. Thank you. like one sentence on each section at most.
Certainly. Overall, this bill has clarifying language to allow follow-through for proper payment on judgments and claims. It's justification for what's paid out of the contractor recovery fund. The first section clarifies the real estate development is not an owner. The second section clarifies who has obtained judgments, an owner who's obtained judgments for more than one licensee might be able to qualify for compensation of up to $75,000 per licensee with each licensee, and also delete some language that's no longer necessary. Sections 31 and 32 clarify that the applicant needs to submit documents of evidence for out-of-pocket expenses, and that the commissioner doesn't have to act until the application is complete.
Representative Norton, I think maybe it's quicker if they just read
absolutely.
That part.
Absolutely. That would be great. That's why I handed it out.
Is there anybody that has opposition to this bill in the audience? Anybody want to testify on this bill in the audience? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, just quickly, you didn't want to put the 2255 on in this committee. Is it going to another one?
Representative as I understand Norton. It, thank you, Mr. Chair, that we'll be at Higher Ed and Workforce Development and that it can go on there.
Are there what? Are there any other, there's no discussion, does this one go to, this one goes to the General Register? I thought you just said it was going to, I think it goes to Rukum Venus Committee, if I remember right. Yes, so Representative Mahoney renews his motion to pass 3048 and refer it to the Finance Committee with a referral to whatever Rukavina's committee is called. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
Thank you.
Carries. Atkins? Okay, Representative Atkins. Wanna, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Does somebody want to, anybody want to move the bill? Hillstrom, Representative Hillstrom moves the bill. 2902, Representative Atkins, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is my understanding, at least my belief, that there was an A1.
Is there an A1?
And actually, maybe while we're visiting about that.
Representative Atkins, can you explain your bill while we're looking for? You got it? Oh,
I'm okay.
Apparently, it didn't get
it's
out.
Actually, it's actually coded, Mr. Chairman, 810-2250.
Got it.
I do right here.
Okay. Let's see who moved this. Did I move it? Oh, Hillstrom moved it. Hillstrom moves. What was that number again?
It's the 810-2250 amendment. And I believe it, Representative Holberg has one. I believe it's in members' packets, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Atkins, so that's to get in the shape the author wants, correct?
It is, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Atkins, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will keep my comments very brief. I do have a couple dealers here that will also keep their comments brief, but we do want to give you a flavor for the bill. The last couple of summers or a couple of years, especially the last year, we've seen I think the greatest trampling of owner rights that we've seen in decades in Minnesota with the wind-down agreements, termination agreements from manufacturers in Detroit to take away the businesses of local Minnesota companies. Worse yet, not just for the dealers, most of which are family-run stores that have been around for decades, but the thousands and thousands of employees and families that rely upon these dealerships. All we are trying to do is better level the playing field. It doesn't level the playing field between manufacturers and auto dealers, but we're trying to give auto dealers and their employees a little bit more of a shooting or of a fighting chance when it comes to these things. What this does is it the first thing that it does is that if there is a terminated dealership, the manufacturer, if they decide to site a new dealership in that same area, the terminated dealer gets a shot at the first shot at trying to get that dealership back. The second thing it does is it allows a proposed purchaser of a dealership to bring a claim against the manufacturer for unlawful rejection of a dealership transfer. And then finally, it gives the dealer, who's invested sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars into their facilities, certain rights with respect to those facilities in the event that a manufacturer tries to take it away from them or cause problems for them. With that, Mr. Chairman, I have Ms. Shalander here from the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I also have Mr. McGuire from Shakopee's dealership in Shakopee. I've cautioned them, you have a very heavy agenda, however.
Yes,
so the goal will be to make commentary very, very brief.
Ms. Shalander, would you do a very brief commentary until we see if there's opposition?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that. My name is Alyssa Shalander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. We're the trade association, of course, that represents all of the franchised new car and truck dealers here in Minnesota. And because of your time schedule, Mr. Chairman, I will be brief. Representative Atkins did a great job giving you an overview of what has transpired in 2009. Basically, when General Motors and Chrysler went through bankruptcy in 2009, that resulted in 60 Minnesota businesses that were we think unfairly terminated, what the bill would do was it would provide a lifeline to those dealerships so that in the event that those franchises are reopened in those market areas, that the dealer that formerly held that franchise would have the first right to have his store back. basically. We've done quite a bit of negotiation with the auto manufacturers to get to this point. The A10 amendment reflects about, you know, 90% of where we've been and where we need to go. But, Mr. Chairman, I realize that time is short, so I'd like to have one of our terminated dealers give you a brief overview of what happened.
We're going to see. We're going to think about that.
Okay.
Is there anybody in opposition to the bill? Are you okay? Very short, then. Can you have a person, and then because then we'll, and I mean like a minute.
Hello, Mr. Chairperson and members. My name is George McGuire, and I'm a General Motors dealer in Shakopee, Minnesota, Shakopee Chevrolet and Pontiac. I'm a profitable, well-capitalized business that continues to this day being profitable. I employ about 40 people that are union members. Well, not all of them, but the service area they are. And in my termination, it was very brief. It just said you're not going to have your contract renewed in October of next year. This process puts me in a very difficult position because, A, I'm a profitable business and I employ about 40 people. In October, I will lose my sign in the air and I will no longer be able to make contributions to the union pension fund. That union pension fund covers the retirement of my union members and I pay their health care and benefits, so on and so forth. There are 33 dealers that are signatories to that deal. Anyway, in October of next year, I won't be able to make those contribution payments. Therefore, it will force an automatic withdrawal. When the automatic withdrawal happens, of no fault of my own, because I've been making the pension payments, I'll be responsible for about $1.5 million worth of the pension liability. So they'll have taken my store, they'll hand me a bill for $1.5 million, the pension will, and my employees will have virtually an impossible time trying to get jobs to continue earning a pension or to continue earning a living. So in essence, it's entire financial ruin for me. I don't come from a family of wealth. I am a self-earned or made person that's worked very hard and leveraged everything I own personally towards this business.
Okay, Ms. Nairn, do you want to come up? Thank you. Is there anybody else that wants to speak on this from the audience? Okay, Ms. Nairn, state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sandy Nairn, and I'm here on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. The Alliance is a trade association of the 10 largest car manufacturers in the world. It does include General Motors and Chrysler, which are the two who went bankrupt last year and are the main reason for this legislation that's before you today. As Ms. Schlander mentioned, there are over a dozen issues that were in this bill when it was introduced, and we have resolved most of them. There are two remaining issues, however, that cause us some problems. Okay. We are continuing to talk to the dealers, and I'm hopeful we'll work them out, but I do want to bring them to your attention. The first one's on page 8, lines 2 through 10. This is a language that gives legal standing to a potential buyer of a dealership. Right now, if a dealer tries to sell their dealership to someone else and that is denied by the manufacturer, the dealer themselves can sue the manufacturer. This would give standing to a potential transferee. This language appeared in legislation that the dealers brought forward in 2000, and in 2001 it was rejected both times by the legislature. At that time, I don't think this section has a lot to do with the bankruptcies, but it is in the bill again. The other section is section 9 of the bill as it was introduced. This language, in the opinion of some lawyers, attempts to override the bankruptcy court decision in the General Motors and Chrysler case and give legal standing to dealers to recoup their dealerships. That provision has passed in 4 other states and is now in litigation in federal bankruptcy court in New York. Chrysler has sued every state that has passed that. So,
thank you.
It's our position that both of these provisions adversely impact the other manufacturers, not just General Motors and Chrysler. We also think they potentially both have fiscal implications. One of them creates a new cause of action to bring to courts. The other one will certainly probably result in Minnesota being joined in the federal bankruptcy challenge that Chrysler has now brought to every state that has passed Section 9 of this bill. And that is all
thank you.
I have to say at this point. These are the only two sections outstanding. As I mentioned, we are trying to work them out still, but we haven't quite reached that point yet.
Just so I just want to make clear for Ms. Nairn, so it's not just GM and Chrysler that is causing the angst from the auto manufacturers.
And that is the reason that we still have concerns. This affects all the manufacturers, not just General Motors and Chrysler, the two provisions that I mentioned.
Are there any other questions? We'll move this. Okay, there's no other questions? Okay, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 2902 as amended, and it goes to the General Register. Is that correct, Representative?
That's correct.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
What were we going to do? Representative Hayden. Usually you can see.
It was right there.
Representative Hayden. The committee doesn't wait for Representative Hayden. Okay, Representative Hayden. Does somebody want to move House File 3088 and it goes to Finance? Representative Champion, do you want to move House File 3888 and refer to Finance?
So moved, Your Honor.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 38 is a Children and Family Services technical and policy clarification, and I am going to, in the interest of time, turn this right over to Ms. Ann Sullivan Sutton to walk you through the bill.
Yes.
From the Department of Human Services.
Last Sutton, anyhow. I can't remember the whole
thing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Ann Sullivan Sutton. I'm with the Department of Human Services. The Article 3 is the article that's pertinent to this committee's jurisdiction, and there are only a couple of sections in Article 3 that I will cover. To give you some very brief background, under current law, counties are required to give children in foster care the opportunity to remain in care from 18 until 21. Up until some recent federal changes, the cost of foster care was borne solely by counties from 18 to 21. Congress passed legislation in 08 that allows counties to draw down federal financial participation to support the cost of those placements if they meet eligibility requirements. So the few changes here would put Minnesota Juvenile Code consistent with the federal requirements to allow children to remain in foster care from 18 to 21 if they are pursuing an education program, participating in a program to reduce barriers to employment, employed, or incapable due to a medical condition. The relevant sections are Section 5, which is a definitional section, and then Section 4 is simply a very technical cross-reference to a correct section of law. Sections 6, 7, 8, and 9 are the other provisions related to bringing down the federal financial participation. These sections include eligibility for foster care benefits, attention to the child's independent living plan, and legal provisions for placement authority in court jurisdiction, including allowing the court to retain jurisdiction until the youth reaches 21 if that child remains in care.
Okay. Is there anybody that wants to speak on this from the audience? Anybody wants to speak on this? No. Okay. Questions for comments from the committee? Okay. Representative Champion renews his motion to pass House File 38 and refer to Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hayden.
3088.
Representative Johnson moves House File 3039. And where does this go? Representative Hayden, where does this go? Does this go to Finance? Or?
No, it's not. Actually, I have an amendment, so it will not go to Finance. So I have a A4 amendment.
Is that in the packets?
No.
It's not in the packets. Okay.
Just to get it in the shape. And then I also have an oral amendment that will keep it from going to Finance.
Representative Johnson moves the A4 amendment. And do you want to,
Do you want to do an oral? Is it pretty simple?
Well, it deletes the lines that eliminates the fiscal note. So it's deletion 6.3 to 6.12.
Oh, not of your A4.
Oh, no, not of my A4. No, so I have an addition to.
Let's do the A4 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Period. Okay, that's in there. And now you have a simple oral amendment?
Yeah, I think so. This bill, as it, we found out from the department that it garnered a very small but enough of a fiscal note that required it to go to finance, and we'd rather it not go there for now. So we want to delete line 6.3 to 6.12.
Mr. Gehring, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, so the intent is just delete section 2 from the bill?
Yes.
Is that correct, Representative Hayden? All you'd want to do is delete section 2?
That's correct.
Okay. Then to get in the shape the way the author wants, the oral amendment is to delete section 2 of the bill. Is that correct? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hayden, go ahead.
Then there's one more oral amendment, if you will. This is just to make sure that it is consistent. The new language is on line 26.18 through 26.20, beginning with who and ending with 14.
Mr. Gehring, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, again, I think on page 26, just delete section 3. We'll take care of that.
Representative Hayden, is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you want... it's easier if you are deleting a section just to tell us which section.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to be precise.
Okay.
Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Johnson moves deletion of section 3. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Okay. Are we ready?
We are ready. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. I'm going to turn it over to Lori Simke, who's going to walk us through the bill to make sure we can get through all the things we need to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Simke. I'm the program director for systemic reform at the Children's Law Center of Minnesota. I'm going to summarize two of the court-related portions of this bill. The first portion does deal with jurisdiction to 21. Article 2, sections 3, 4, 5, and 8 contain identical language to the provisions in House File 3088. Which we just discussed and just passed through this committee, extending jurisdiction to age 21 for youth staying in foster care. The difference in our bill is Article 2, Section 6, which is also being amended today. It's an additional provision amending language to more clearly reference these new jurisdiction to 21 provisions and clarifying how they apply to state wards. We consulted with the Department of Human Services on Article 2, Section 6, and the language that we have here, and it was agreed that this amendment is necessary for clarity and consistency in the statutes with those new changes. The second portion of our bill is Article 3, which clarifies that the court reviews of foster care matters, which are required by state and federal law, are to be held in in-court hearings, which gives all the parties the opportunity to attend. So these changes encourage court engagement of youth in the review process and really clarifies in statute what's already set forth in the court rules.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now that you require in-court appearances, that doesn't have a fiscal cost?
We're not aware that any additional cost is going to be necessary for these changes. We've not heard from anyone that any additional costs are necessary. These are clarifications in the statutory language of what the requirements that are already present in the court rules. It's not changing any of the frequency of the hearings. The intervals between reviews is the same. The findings that the court has to make are the same. And the review is itself the same. We're just asking that that it be done in court so that all the parties are able to attend.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if there's a guardian ad litem or an attorney, or I don't know, is there a court-appointed attorney, there would be no added expense for those items?
We haven't received any objections based on cost as of yet, and our understanding is that this is the obligations for everyone other than simply coming to court to sit down to talk about the matter. The reporting requirements of the guardian ad litem is the same. The county the agency's requirement to submit a report is the same. This really just really adds the child's voice and allows them, include or foster parents as well, to appear and contribute to the review process so that it's not simply on paper.
One final. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it permits the foster child to appear and it permits the foster parent to appear, but are they required to attend?
No. No. Under the, and I'm sorry, Ms. Representative Hillstrom, the bill and the full framework of the child protection statutes and rules state that parties and participants have the right to participate. Children and foster parents have the right to appear, but they don't have to appear. If children don't attend, the rules are clearly state that any of the parties that may not attend, that the hearing can still proceed without them as long as there was sufficient notice. So we think that in the context of the full statutes and the rules applying to these proceedings, it's clear that it doesn't require their attendance. It just really gives them the opportunity to appear.
I'm finished,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymer, are you okay with not going to finance?
Is it going to finance?
Well, yeah. They said no, but many of us think
yeah.
It's kind of, it sounds like it's in your finance committee.
Does the committee?
Representative Mahoney.
You have a
Mr. Chair, to the witness, what you're saying is the courts are required to have all these people, the ad litems, the county, the lawyers, and everybody else there now, correct?
Ms. Sutton.
The real problem is that in there are just a few counties that have a practice of having non-appearance reviews. The review is happening, the court is doing the review. A couple counties have interpreted the statutory language, we think, to allow for a non-appearance review, basically just a paper review. So notice is sent out about the review, but it's indicated that it's not an appearance review, so no one has the opportunity to come. It's not going to be held in court. So this would just simply allow for the opportunity for parties that want to participate to be able to participate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney.
So, we have 87 counties in the state. 85 counties are sending this notice out now and allowing whoever they notify to come and speak in front of the open court.
That's our understanding. Our experience is that we're seeing this in a couple of counties, and we're asking for a small change in the law to make it consistent, because it's clearly set out in the court rules that these reviews should be in court. We're just asking to clarify that the intent of this is to allow the judge to have all the critical information to be able to make those determinations about best interests and of the child. And that's supposed to be an individualized determination. So we're asking that the language be changed to clarify what the obligation is under the rules.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So all you're asking in this is that this really will only affect a couple of counties, and you're just telling them to do what all the other 85 counties are doing, correct?
Correct.
Ms. Sutton.
Representatives.
And I have a question. When it was presented in my office, I thought you said there were quite a few counties that were doing this, and if we're adding another hearing possible, it would seem that it should go to Representative Paymar's committee, but that's up to Representative Paymar, I guess. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having practiced in this field a few years ago, not too long ago, as county attorney, it sounds very much, although I can't swear to it because I haven't read every word of this, but it sounds very much like you're going to have some kind of court costs possible that you need to at least look at from a finance point of view.
That was my concern, too. Representative Famer, it's your call.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, would you be willing to get a fiscal note on this and let it go through finance so we can be assured that it's not going to cost the court any?
Mr. Chair, Representative Famer, yeah, absolutely. This wasn't the track that we came down and we hadn't heard, but yeah, I think that would be appropriate just to be sure that it wasn't going to add cost or any significant cost to the court.
I think Representative Famer would like to see this. Okay, is there any other discussion of this? Okay, then Representative Johnson renews his motion, except changes it to go to finance with a referral.
We still have one more portion of the bill to.
You're almost out of here. You don't need to say anything.
No, I'm sorry. Be quiet. I just want to be thorough. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just proceed as you were going down the track.
Boy, how to lose a bill. Representative Johnson renews his motion, except changes it that it go to the Finance Committee with a re-referral to Public Safety on House File 3039 as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
3299. Representative Boland moves House File 3299. And this goes where? Representative Hayden?
Where did this go back? No, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I know. It's going to the general register.
It goes to the, okay. Representative Olin made the motion to pass House File 3299 and send it to the general register, and we're being handed out some new amendments. Representative Hayden, is this another amendment for your?
I just have the A1 amendment that we're moving.
Okay. Representative Olin moves the A1 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is the agency's child support bill, and without further ado, I'll let Ms. Olson from the department walk you through the bill. Any changes?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Olson. I'm a staff attorney at the Department of the Human Services and the Child Support Division. This bill contains two provisions, both aimed at increasing the efficiency of the 4D Child Support Agency. Section 1 expands on the information the 4D Child Support Agency is currently allowed to request from employers, utility companies, financial institutions, on child support participants. It adds mobile telephone numbers, home telephone numbers, and email addresses to the list of information that the 4D Child Support Agency is currently allowed to request. Section 1 also clarifies the definition of utility companies to include mobile phone companies, satellite television companies, and internet service providers. Section 2 and 3 provide for the administrative redirection of child support. This provision was heard and passed through this committee last year, so I won't expand on that any further, but I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Does anybody from the audience want to testify on this bill? Anyone want to testify on this bill? Okay, questions from members? Any questions from members? Okay, then Representative Olin renews his motion to.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Scott, I didn't see.
Yes, can we divide a bill in committee here?
Yes, we can.
I'm just wondering if we could divide the bill. Let's see.
Representative Scott, how do you want to divide the bill?
The first part of the
it'd be divided after line 2.30. That would be the first portion of the bill would be, you know, lines 1.1 through 2.30.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it your intention then to delete section 2 on or to delete section 1 on? Or
we don't necessarily have to delete either one of them, just divide it into two separate bills. Is that feasible?
Yes.
No? She's no. Shaking her head.
How do you do that, Mr. Chair? I don't think you can. You only have one bill before you, Mr. Chair. I think you can delete one section off or you can...
Okay, then I would move to delete the first 1.1 through 2.30. If that's correct.
Section one. Unless you're going to amend the other section onto another.
Section one.
I don't know why you can't, but if that's what you, what was your motion is to take.
Delete section one.
Okay. Is there, go ahead with discussion to your motion.
I think that the second part of the bill I like, of course. I had it last session. I think the redirection of child support is a really, it's a fundamentally, it's a good thing to do. It saves the state and the courts time and administrative work. The first portion, I don't care for it. I don't think the two are should be carried in the same bill.
Representative Payton.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. The first part of the bill is simply that as we, it's our practice to ask the public utilities for help to locate people for child support. And as we have moved forward in our times, people now have, you know, we have people that have cell phones that don't have home phones. We've added satellite television. A lot of people are using email as a way to communicate. And so we are simply just expanding the definition of a utility so that we are able to help the department locate or the counties locate and find folks who need to pay child support.
Representative Mahoney, you had a comment or question?
I have a question and then a comment. Representative Hayden, did you talk to anyone such as the insurance companies or organized labor or the financial institutions about handing out this kind of information? Because I know that, Mr. Chair, labor organizations would not be really very thrilled handing out their list of members to anyone, and we protect that information very, very carefully.
Ms. Halford, Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, as you'll see currently in Minnesota statutes 256.978, the Authority Child Support Agency is already authorized to seek information from labor organizations and insurance companies and financial institutions and employers. Right now, if you look at the statute as it currently reads, we're allowed to get wage or payment information, benefit information, social security numbers. This is simply a slight clarification to add on mobile telephone numbers and email addresses and home work and mobile telephone addresses and email addresses. It's a very slight clarification to information that we're already authorized to get from these organizations.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So the answer to the question is no, you didn't?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, no, we have not consulted them with this slight clarification in this edition.
And then, Mr. Chair, the comment that I have is this something that should go to data privacy? Well, we do now. I think Friday or Tuesday.
Well, actually, since it's a subcommittee of this committee, it can take it up as long as it's part of the whole bill, which really kind of is.
Mr. Chair?
I can't keep track. Oh, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, I guess I just want to understand that the question you ask is already in law that we can do that. And we are doing that. So I just want to be sure that the question that you're asking is, and I'm just getting a clarification that is pertaining to, you think it needs to go to data privacy to get mobile mobile telephones or email addresses. You think that that is it, or that we should revisit the issue of could we get the information from labor and other institutions that we already get it from?
Representative Mahoney, I don't think that that, I think we can vote, we should vote on it here, but, and I'm tending to worry about not even talking to labor organizations about this, but that's really not a Chapter 13 type of issue as far as data privacy is my understanding. Since, first of all, data privacy applies to government, and a labor organization is not government.
That's just, Mr. Chair, I then stand corrected, but I still, I am at some level concerned, and I'll probably vote with vote for this motion on the mobile phones and email addresses when you don't include people into the particular bill and into the conversation. This is, you know, I know how much trouble. And Mr. Chair, I belong to a labor organization. I can't get that list. I can't get those phone numbers from my own members, from my own organization. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, I have some issues with this.
Representative Holberg, I think you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, is your organization subject to the same rules like a debt collector would be? I mean, if you look at the existing language, it's really clear it's limited to these things. So the public policy around that was you can only get this certain subset of data from these organizations that have information on individuals. What you're asking us to do here by adding work telephone numbers, et cetera, I understand the dilemma with people now just having cell phones and not home phones, and certainly we want to be able to collect information and money from people that are behind in their child support, et cetera, but I don't think that we should give a government entity access to information and then allow them to harass people at work or, you know, whatever. So, I mean, it's pretty clear that the public policy was around limiting access to information. So what you're trying to do here by expanding it to work phone, mobile phone, email address, what constraints are there as you're acting as a pseudo debt collector, if you will, on how you can use this information?
Ms. Holberg, or I'm sorry, Representative Holberg, just to be correct, they already can get the work phone, but not the mobile phone and email address.
Mr. Chair, in some instances, if you look, utility company, you can get the work phone, but from employers, you can't get the work phone. And
some of them are each way.
Yeah, so I mean, it's. And, I mean, you say that it's not Chapter 13, but data practices bills govern in general how government entities have access to and use information. So what's before us today is what type of access and authority we're going to give to the child support collection arm of the government, what information we're going to give them access to. And so
it would bring it into the government, and then whatever presently is in Chapter 13 regarding that information would be what was applicable. But Ms. Olson, could you answer her question?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, when you see work, to address the question regarding the work telephone number and home telephone number, what we did, we have four places that we can seek this information from: employers, insurance companies, financial institutions, and labor organizations. And what we were trying to do here is just make the information we could request from each consistent. And so that's why you'll see, you know, some include work telephone number, some just include mobile telephone number. And you'll see, as I pointed out before, that the Child Support Agency already has very broad authority to get private information from these institutions and organizations, you know, including social security numbers, wages, wage information. So I don't think we're really trying to open this up here. What we're looking at doing is just trying to bring this statute up and bring it into the 21st century now that people are using the mobile telephones more and email addresses more. It's just basically to get that additional information if it's available to these four groups.
And Mr. Chair, what I'm looking for is Can you call somebody at work after they ask you not to call them there?
Or Ms. Olson?
Representative Ms. Chair, or I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, in attempting to locate child support obligors, I believe a child support officer would be able to telephone someone at work. Whether or not they would continue to call them after work, probably not.
Representative Holberg.
And this is what I'm just trying to get at, that if you're, let's say you're a debt collector and you have somebody's work number, if you call them at work as an individual, you have the right to say, you can't call me at work anymore, and they can't. Okay, I'm wondering, does an individual have that same right of your organization? I haven't really heard an answer to that. And so when we, if we support this policy decision, you know, you already have very, very broad latitude in what you can do, and maybe that's right and maybe that's wrong. But I'm sure there are some employers that would not appreciate the Department of Human Services calling every other day somebody at work trying to get money out of them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden. I think people have discussed this pretty much. Representative Drutkowski, do we want to? I think everybody understands where they probably are on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would just reiterate, as we look at page 2 of the bill, section 2.21 in that area, 2.20, we are defining utilities to include satellite providers, internet service providers, as well as cell phone companies. Many of these companies have developed agreements with their subscribers that there will be confidentiality. We're going to take an arm of government to extend in and to violate those agreements between the subscribers and the companies. That's very problematic to me.
I think we're going to vote on this. We are kind of beating it. Representative Scott renews her motion to delete section 1. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Back to the bill as amended. Representative Hayden, I think you've already described section 2. Is there anybody from the audience? We already asked that. Any further discussion on the bill as amended by Representative Scott's motion? Okay, then Representative Olin renews his motion to pass House File 3299 as amended and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hayden, do you have an agreement on this one? 2824.
We have an oral amendment that we'll offer that will help.
Which amendment? Which bill, sir?
2824. Representative Hayden, in the future, can you, first of all, authorize the House staff to get the amendments to us so we can put them in the packet so people can have them in the packet rather than handing them out at the hearing? And also, I realize sometimes you have to make oral amendments, but we've had a lot of amendments coming today at the hearing.
I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chair. We were working out an agreement, and it just didn't come in the way that the realtors needed to see it. And so to move this on, we thought that we would just strike a section that would then get us in agreement. So it was a deal that was in the works that just ran out of time.
So, Representative Hayden, you do have an agreement with them if that section is stricken? Is that it?
Yes, sir.
That's okay, correct. And does it go then to the General Register or where?
Yes, on to the General Register.
Okay, I will move House File 2824 to go to the General Register, and could you state the oral agreement? Is it a section again?
We'll remove Section 4.
Okay, the motion is to move, I will move removing Section 4 to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries by about 1-0. Representative Hayden, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2824 is a a small but important change that will enhance the city's ability to respond to problem property. It was some changes and enhancements to a bill that we passed last year. I'm going to pass this on to Ms. Reed from the city of Minneapolis and a testifier to get us through.
Okay. Are you going to testify now?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Melissa Reed with the City of Minneapolis. I'm going to walk through the bill, and then I'm going to turn it over to Grant Wilson, who's our Director of Problem Properties, to provide a little bit more detail and a little bit more background as to
why. Okay, this may sound like we're heading for a long time. Is there any opposition to the bill as amended? Mr. Dunleavy, let's find out what the opposition first is before we spend a long time having an explanation of things that aren't an issue. Mr. Dunleavy, could you state, obviously your name, whether you're representing the real estate section, and what particular issues there are?
My name is Kevin Dunleavy. I co-chair the real property, the legislative committee of the real property section. The Bar Association hasn't taken a formal position on this file, so I'm not testifying as a representative of the Bar Association, just as an attorney that spent 400 pro bono hours in the last two legislatures working on foreclosure legislation.
It's your own choice.
It was pro bono.
When he got the wonderful job as the chair of the legislative section, the real property section of the bar.
I think that removing Section 4 improves the bill, but I still have technical concerns about other portions of the bill, and I'm happy to work with Ms. Reed and the author to address those concerns. I don't know if you want to get into that much detail at this point.
So you and Representative Hayden, I did tell you that I knew that they had issues and you should work with them. It's up to to Mr. Dunleavy. Do you think it's Representative Mahoney?
And this is a question for the author and the advocates of for the bill. Sometimes you just come to the impasse and you can't agree and you want to do something and the technical changes change the whole bill. So,
right.
And to either one of the witnesses or the author, are you at that particular point where technical changes change the nature of the bill and would not do what it needs to do?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I don't believe so. I think that we have a lot more to discuss. Would it be helpful for me to walk through the bill to maybe, and then Mr. Dunleavy can address his technical concerns more specifically?
Well, I'd rather have the technical concerns brought up, because to walk through uncontested, we don't have a lot of time to walk. It sounded like you were preparing for quite a Mr. Dunleavy, could you?
Okay, Section 2 of the bill, delivery of the notice of sale to the political subdivisions. The concern I have with that is oftentimes you can't tell what municipality a property is located. My house is in Shoreview, but I also have a St. Paul address. So it would actually take a fair amount of technical research in a lot of cases to figure out where a property is located. What township? What if it's not an incorporated township? Where does the notice go? Does it go to the county? Does it just go in the round file? That's the technical concern on that.
I'm sorry, Mr. Dunleavy. Where's that section?
That is Section 2 of the bill. The cities apparently want the notice of foreclosure sale to be mailed to the cities in addition to being served on the debtor, the property owner. And so there's some questions about, well, what city, how do you know, those kinds of things. And then how do you prove that you did it so that you have a valid foreclosure once you do the foreclosure? Then Section 3 of the bill, the technical concern is the address and phone number of the property, the mortgagee and the who has authority. I think that's been argued before in other legislation. So as long as it's similar to other legislation that's been enacted, it's probably okay. Section
where's that? Four, Mr. Dunleavy, which part is okay?
Section 3.
Okay.
If it's the same as other legislation that's already been enacted. And I haven't looked at that.
Okay.
Okay, section 5 of the bill talks about costs to reduce the redemption period. Right now, creditors are not allowed to charge the debtor for the cost of reducing the redemption period, and so it's a, I guess it's a public policy question of whether the legislature wants to allow cities to do that when currently the mortgage creditors can't do it. And that's the same issue with section 6 of the bill. Section 7 of the bill that's also a question of the cost, the public policy question. That's not my decision, that's the legislature's decision. Does it want to allow the cities to assess costs to the, especially to the creditor that's doing the foreclosure when the city gets a 5-week redemption period? But my main technical concern is, how do you prove up that the notice was given?
That's the notice in section 2 here?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Reed, I'm very concerned. I don't know why the city of Minneapolis, which apparently is backing this since you're with this, why they don't contact the Bar Association, Real Property, on, we've had this same problem that they don't do this, and for a few years at least, as we've been going through a lot of foreclosure legislation, it would really help if they would contact the Bar Association and find out their input. I think everybody else that I know of is doing that.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, we did. We just,
you did?
We have been going back and forth and just trying to get everything nailed into place. And so we have been communicating. We did last year as well.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, this bill isn't ready. I move to lay it on the table.
That's not debatable. Okay, all in favor of laying it on the table, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
It's laid on the table. This is just... Representative Huntley. Representative Jackson moves House File 3279, and it goes to government operations. Is that correct?
That's what I was told. Is that wrong? Or?
Pardon?
Does it go to government operations?
It's state and local government.
Right.
Whatever their name is now.
Yeah.
It's got about 10 words in it. Representative Huntley, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, this is trying to set up a system to regulate what are called health information exchanges. And health information exchanges are groups that supply the ability of one clinic to talk to another clinic that they're not owned by, or a clinic and a hospital can exchange information about a particular patient. We are going to be required, there's at least one of these is already up and running in Minnesota. It happens to be in my part of the state. And I know all the groups associated with it, the various hospital systems, clinics, think they're doing a great job. The federal law passed recently about health information exchange will mandate certain things that we have to abide by. And if we do that, and if we look like we have a good system, then that will mean that the providers in Minnesota, the healthcare providers, will be eligible over the next several years to collect 450 to 800 million federal government because they're doing a good job of transferring this information. And let me give you an example of where this might be useful. And that's for the last 30 years, I've been going to Wyoming every summer to go mountain biking. And three times I've crashed, only one semi-seriously. And where I go, they would haul me into the hospital in Laramie, Wyoming, And if it was really serious, the hospital in Laramie, Wyoming, can't do very much, so they'd probably fly me to Fort Collins, Colorado. So one accident gets me in two states, and all my health records are back here in Minnesota. Wouldn't it be nice if the hospital in Fort Collins, if I was seriously injured, could get my medical records? If I or my wife said, yes, go ahead and do it. And that's what these there are already exchanges between certain parts of the state that are working. And but what the federal government will require us to do is to have any one of these exchanges be able to communicate with another one or anyone in the country. And what this bill does is set up basically a board to oversee these exchanges and make sure that the state of Minnesota meets its responsibilities so we can get those extra federal dollars for our health care providers. There are two sections in this bill that relate to this committee. They are on page 6, lines 9 to 14, and page 12, line, I think it's 14, to page 13.35. And I will have Dr. Golden explain the details of those two sections.
Doctor, there's apparently...
Did you want me to... I mean, we could move that amendment if it, it relates... the A-10-2269 amendment relates to this particular part of the information.
2269? Is that to get it in the author's shape?
Yes, except I would have to give you an oral amendment to that amendment. On line 1, where it says, move to amend House File number 3279, you should insert there the first engrossment.
Okay.
And this amendment relates to a discussion we had in the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. There was some discussion about the section we had, and so this clarifies that and removes section that had.
We will, Representative Jackson moves 2269 as printed with the oral addition of after 3279, then the first engrossment. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and that's to get in the shape you want it?
Yes.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
No.
Aye. All opposed? No.
No.
Okay. Okay.
Mr.
Chair? Yes.
I have a question about this. I know you're trying to move along, but...
Oh, well, there'd be questions. Or did... We're just putting this into the shape that the author wanted. And then there'll be plenty of time for questions. I know that there's some controversy on this. And I can't remember, was it Dr. Goldman?
Golden.
Golden.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Now, Representative Huntley, do you want this, is this your 2271 or is that somebody else's?
That is also mine. And again, this I should also have that same amendment put in there, and but this does not relate to this committee, so if you don't want to do it here, we don't have to do it here.
Oh, I'm sorry, what did you just say?
It does. This section does not relate to what's usually done in this committee.
So
I could add that later.
Okay, so you don't want that
now.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the Director of Health Policy at the Department of Health. What the bill does, it has a number of sections. The first section creates a Health Information Exchange Oversight Board. That is a 7-member board that is responsible for reviewing the activity of these types of organizations that Representative Huntley was talking about that provide health information exchange services. That's established in one section. The very next section has the criteria to be one type of health information exchange provider. That is one that provides a subset of the federal requirements. The next section lays out the criteria to be something called a health information organization. This is an organization that meets all of the criteria to meet the federal requirements. The next section lays out the application for either of those two organizations to apply to be that type of organization. That is the application that the board would go through and review and make a recommendation on. And then finally, the last section is an enforcement section, which provides authority to have administrative penalties as well as suspension and revocation of their certificate when they are not acting in compliance with the criteria or the information supplied as part of their application. So that's the general background for the bill. The first section that Representative Huntley pointed out that would be under this committee's jurisdiction is on lines 6.9 through 6.20, and that includes now the A-10 amendment. What this does is two things. On lines 6.9 through 6.11, it says when the Oversight Board is considering certain types of contracts, that would be between the health exchange entity as well as their contractors. Certain of those contracts are not public. The next thing says that when the Health Information Exchange Oversight Board is actively doing an investigation, while the investigation is ongoing, all of the information is not public information. However, with the amendment that you just put on, the board may release that information if it's necessary to protect the health or safety of patients. And then under F on line 617, after the Health Information Exchange Oversight Board concludes its investigatory activities, all information is public. The next section that is relevant for this committee is the enforcement component, which starts on line 12, on page 12, line 14. The first thing that it goes through is the administrative penalties. It puts the penalty amount as well as any factors that must be considered in assessing any of the penalties. And then on page 13, provides all of the due process for notifying the entity that would be fined. These are consistent with all of the other general authorities in issuing a penalty. It also provides the opportunity for the entity receiving a penalty to do a contested case, as well as follow up as a result of that. Then on page 14, there is the process for a suspension or revocation. It gives those specific conditions in which a suspension or revocation would be appropriate as opposed to an administrative fine. It then goes through the administrative process that must be followed before anyone can have a suspension or a revocation. And I would be more than happy to answer any specific questions you might have.
Okay, Representative Holberg, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, with the 2269 amendment, does that only apply in the case if they're doing an investigation?
Mr. Chair,
Dr. Bold.
Representative Holberg, yes, that is correct.
And just
Mr. Holberg.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gold, or Dr. Golden, I'm sorry, is there any situation that you are aware of with this Health Information Exchange Oversight Board where they might disclose data, confidential data about an individual?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, no, I am not.
Representative Holberg.
So, Mr. Chair, you cannot think of any instance in which confidential data about an individual may be a risk to the public?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, no, the Health Information Exchange Oversight Board would not have patient data What they would be investigating is this company doing what it said it was going to be doing? And if not, why not? How is it not meeting what it had said it was going to do in its application? You know, the type of a concern that one would think about with regard to patient safety is, for example, in the course of an investigation, you learn that a health information exchange organization was mixing patient records or wasn't sending the correct information between one provider and another. And that might create a type of risk to a patient. And so, again, that's an example of where you would want to inform the clinic or the hospital that there might be some concerns so that they could take appropriate action. Again, it's not that you're disclosing to them specific patient information, but you are telling them about a concern that is under investigation about the operations of one of their vendors.
And
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Golden, this information that these organizations hold, are they able to share them amongst each other for research purposes?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, the hospitals, the organizations, the data that they hold, the health information exchange service providers, no, they would not be able to share their information for research purposes. Generally speaking, they would not be holding patient information, but even if they were to be holding patient information, there's nothing in this bill that would allow them to exchange it or share it in any way other than going through the consent processes that are already in either statute, state, federal, or human protections.
All right. And Mr. Chair and Dr. Golden, under current law, does an individual have to specifically give consent for participation in this sharing on a case-by-case basis?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, yes, under Minnesota Statute 144.293, for the exchange of any health information, except for very limited exceptions like an emergency, a patient does need to consent. Additionally, to the degree that any of these exchange organizations have a record locator, which would allow a hospital to find where a patient's records might be located, the patient has the right to opt out of that as well.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I have the A2 amendment, which would require individual consent before their records would be connected to these organizations. And if it's appropriate, I'd like to move that amendment now.
Representative Holberg, let me take Representative Hellstrom's question.
Certainly.
And then we'll come back to that.
Mr.
Or
Chair.
Question or comment?
It was a question, Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley. I just wanted to make really clear that none of this data would be allowed to be used to say have something considered a pre-existing condition or any of that, correct?
Dr. Golden.
For insurance purposes or coverage purposes?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is correct. There is nothing about this bill that would allow a provider to share information with an insurance company or for an insurance company to otherwise access information without the patient's consent for any purpose, including pre-existing conditions.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, did you have a follow-up? No. Okay, then we'll go to Representative Holberg, and she moves amendment 3279A2.
But Mr. Chair, I think Holberg, to Representative Hillstrom's point, many times when you go into the doctor's office, you're required to provide that your medical record can be shared with insurance companies for billing purposes.
Representative Huntley,
could you repeat that amendment? We don't have a copy of the amendment.
Here.
Oh. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Ms. Brace wants to speak to this amendment.
Well, first we'll let the author and his witness speak to it.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I've had a chance to look at this amendment, and the amendment I don't think quite makes sense, and let me explain why it doesn't quite fit into the bill. What the section that it is amending is trying to do, there's a section of Minnesota Statute 62J.495, which is in Subdivision 1, which is not being amended, and so consequently it is not in the bill. But what that section says is that by January 1st of 2015, all hospitals and healthcare providers must have in place an interoperable electronic health record system. And what that requirement says is that hospitals and clinics need to have a computer system that is an electronic health record. And so one of the questions that the legislature and the department has gotten since that has been passed in 2007 is the question, what does it mean to have an interoperable electronic computer system? And what this section of the bill that is being amended says is what it means to have an interoperable electronic health record system, computer system, is to be connected to one of these health information exchange organizations. And so this is really, this section is about the computer level, not about any individual health record. And so quite clearly, a hospital may connect now. This doesn't actually change that, but what we're simply trying to do with the bill is identify what does interoperable mean. Interoperable means that you must connect to this. And so the concern that Representative Holberg is raising, that in order for an individual's health record to be exchanged, you need the patient consent, that is already in current law, and changing the must to the may would in no way affect that, either positively or negatively. This section is talking about computer systems at large, and the concern is about an individual's health record.
Ms. Brace, did you want to testify on this? Or this is also not just Ms. Brace. Does anybody else want to testify on this amendment? You can come up also. Ms. Brace, state your name. You know
yes.
The procedures.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the issue of consent is really perhaps been misstated here, in that the consent requirement that I understand that Mr. Golden was talking about is a consent requirement for when you go into your dentist's office, let's say, and your dentist says, you know, I'd like to have your previous medical records or your previous dental records, and is that okay? I've got this certain service that'll do that for me. Is that okay? And you say, sure. Well, now that's considered consent by the bill. That's not informed. They don't know what they're doing. That's consent to get into the record locator service where all the medical records have been placed without consent. So right now, medical record information can be shared without consent with health information exchanges. The patient has nothing to say about it being shifted to these corporations. We have no idea how many corporations this is. It could just be two. I have no idea. But the point is that there is not consent today. And if anyone looks at HIPAA, the federal so-called privacy rule, that actually opened up the medical records and took away consent requirements.
Thank you. He's not on this issue. Okay. Is there any other, Representative Hutley, did you want to comment before we vote on Amendment 8-2?
Mr. Chair and members, Minnesota already has the strictest requirements for patient privacy protection of records in the country, and I don't think we need to change those.
Representative Mahoney.
I was just going to ask the author to be specific if he liked this and thought we should vote for it or not, but I think he just did.
I think he said that he wants a no vote, I believe.
I think that's clear. Okay, then all in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
No's carry. Thank you. Back to the bill. Is there anybody that wants to speak about the bill? Ms. Bray. And is that Mr. Fraser? Is that? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Twyla Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare. And I'm sorry that the consent amendment did not get on, and I think it's really important to say that the we don't actually have the consent or privacy provisions that a lot of people think we do. In fact, the health department has full authority to conduct research without our consent. 62J.321 gives the health department full access to information without our consent. It's always been very controversial. And so the idea that there's going to be a few corporations that are going to get access to our information without our consent and have it all pulled together is very concerning. Let me just point out on page 8, line 34, that you will see there that it's very clear that for one of these systems to be considered certified, it has to be able to hook up with the nationwide health information network. Essentially, what we're going to have happen here to our medical records and to our healthcare system is that when you walk into the doctor's office, you will be an open book. There will be no control over who gets to see the information of the last person that you were with, or the a whole variety of information, what kind of pharmacy products you took, what pharmacies you've been to, what clinics you've been to, have you been to a special clinic that just by virtue of the fact of the type of clinic you are at, it tells very clearly what kind of condition that you had. So what we have here is really a threat to the healthcare system, because as soon as people become concerned that their privacy is going to be violated when they walk in, and as soon as they realize that they won't necessarily get a fresh opinion because they'll be able to access every medical record on them in the past, this is really going to cause a problem between patients and doctors and the integrity of the healthcare system. I also do want to point out that I believe that individuals have rights to keep their medical record information out of online systems. I believe that we should protect people from medical identity theft and regular ID theft. And I believe that patient safety is an issue as well as the as the Joint Commission on Hospitals put out an alert, and as the Washington Post did a very special article on it last year. So the idea that individuals have no control over placing their information online, putting it in a big health information exchange so they can be shared not only statewide but nationwide, and that individuals can be profiled, their physician decisions can all be pulled together into one, into a profile, and that every patient can become perhaps a research subject without their consent, given that there are not the consent requirements in here, should be a great concern to you as a committee and to anyone who has a record in a medical system anywhere. Bottom line, the whole interoperability issue is a violation of patient rights, rights that individuals will seek to protect, perhaps to their own medical detriment. The California Healthcare Foundation has already reported 10 years ago, before we were at where we are now, that 15% of Americans were doing things like not going to the doctor's office. They were giving false information, coming in with a false name, trying to make sure that they didn't see the same doctor for everything so the information could not be connected. This is connecting all the information on an individual without the individual's consent. And so anytime someone comes up here and says, well, you have consent, well, the fact of the matter is that you do not. And the other thing is you can just look at it even at your doctor's office and see all the places where you don't have consent, including the Notice of Privacy Practices, which shows how little consent individuals have anymore over their data. And it should be up to this legislature to really protect patients, because protecting their privacy is protecting their access to medical records and their ability to speak frankly with their doctor and get the medical care that they need. So it's really important to protect privacy, not to open up the medical record by putting it online and sharing the data with these corporations over which people have no control.
Thank you. Mr. Fraser?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Fraser. I'm the founder and CEO of MedNetWorld.com, and we're the supplier of the software that runs the CHIC Health Information Exchange up in northern Minnesota. That's the map, shows you the customers on the testimony I handed out. This has been a very successful project, and we're hoping to expand it quickly across northern Minnesota. It is very, very sensitive to the issues of patient privacy. We do not store any health information centrally. It's all stored at the hospitals and clinics in the system. So I wanted to take exception with the characterization with the previous person here that we put everything online. As Dr. Golden said, everything does require patient consent, and the patient has an option to opt out of our system, and that is a requirement of state law. So I think we've been very sensitive to the privacy opt-out and all the other services in the record locator service that we run up there. As it relates to this bill, we have a lot of concerns about this bill. No other state is putting such a regulatory burden on the health information exchanges, which are just emerging. So Minnesota would be the first in putting a oversight board, $35,000 in fees to create one of these organizations, and I think that's burdensome. The other issue here that I'm very concerned about is the issue of competition with a system like this. We're a for-profit corporation working with a nonprofit CHIC organization in Duluth, Minnesota, and I think we've done a very good job in building a state-of-the-art system up there. It is conformant with the national standards. Our engineers sit on the national committees, the Nationwide Health Information Network, by the Department of Health and Human Services. So I think we are very sensitive to the patient privacy, and we are focused on providing connectivity across Minnesota and with the federal government. In fact, we just won a project with the Social Security Administration to link this system so that Social Security can speed up disability determinations from months to days, and this will help injured workers. Which leads me to the main purpose of my testimony here. The state has shown in words and deeds, the Minnesota Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, that they prefer an existing health information exchange called MNHI, that's a corporation, an LLC, based in Minnesota here. MNHI was joined by the Department of Human Services and was funded by over $2 million from the Department of Human Services. The Department of Health staffers have gone up to our project in CHIC, and they have requested that they abandon our project and join the MNHI organization. So as a for-profit corporation, we cannot compete when the state, the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, joins a single organization and also goes up to our customers and tells them to join the opposition, essentially. So this law sets up an oversight board, but in essence, the state has already decided that MNHI will be the functional health information exchange in Minnesota. And finally, last week, Dr. Golden, in his testimony regarding a $9.6 million grant in stimulus funds, testified that he is going to provide $6 million of that directly to MNHI. There was no competitive process for that funding. There was no RFP issued by the state. There was no way for us to apply for those funds. So there is really no way for the CHIC organization and my project up there to compete when federal monies are flowing directly to MNHI, when the Department of Human Services is joining MNHI. So I think from a practical matter, this bill, which I support, by the way, in general, this bill will not heal those problems. It will essentially lock in a single vendor to control all the health information exchanges in Minnesota. And so I am opposed to this bill unless those problems are fixed.
Okay, are there any questions for Mr. Fraser? Okay, Representative Huntley, do you want to reply, or Dr. Golden either? Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I have checked last week with two of the big healthcare providers in the Duluth area, and they're both very satisfied with what they're getting from CHIC. So I personally have no reason to not support them. I think this, however, this bill, and maybe the Department of Health has done some things in the past that weren't appropriate, and I'm going to have a hearing in my committee on what's happened in the past, but I think this bill going forward needs to pass, and we will certainly look at any of Mr. Fraser's concerns.
Okay. Then, let's see. Was Representative Jackson renews her motion? Oh, is there Representative Kelly?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fraser, I'm just curious as to if you have a fix or if you have suggestions for us in this bill that could fix your concerns.
Yes, I have two specific issues. One is the fees. This bill requires nonprofits to operate this, and it imposes $35,000 in fees in the first year and $25,000 fees after that. I would like to see an amendment slashing those by an order of magnitude. That's one request. Secondly, there has been previous legislation that has allowed the Department of Human Services to join a health information exchange, and I would request that be revoked so that the state agencies stay neutral to a competitive landscape where multiple suppliers can supply this technology. So those are two specific issues I think need fixing here.
Representative Holbert.
And if I could just say that also Mr. Fraser and CHIC's costs are a lot lower than what MNHI is proposing.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Huntley, your 2271 amendment, what committee will be dealing with that?
Probably local government.
And Mr.
Chair. Not local, I mean state and local government.
Representative Holberg, I believe it is to be referred to GovOps.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and generally we would have jurisdiction over open meeting law. Will this meeting be governed by open meeting law? In other words, will these meetings be open to the public?
Representative Huntley.
Why don't we have Dr. Golden back?
Dr. Gold.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holper, absolutely. The Health Information Exchange Oversight Board would be subject to the open meeting law.
And
Representative Holper.
Mr. Chair, when the makeup of this committee, you've got seven members and five who are healthcare stakeholders. Could it be feasible that five of the seven actually were associated or had been associated with organizations that stand to benefit financially from this process?
I think it's for Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that is exactly what the 2271 amendment is seeking to address, is the conflict of interest, and that specifically states that the members of the Health Information Exchange Oversight Board may not have a material interest in that, nor may their employer.
And Mr. Chair and Dr. Golden, I fully understand that point, but if you have a seven-member board of which five come from the industry, and it's feasible that they all, given the breadth of what's being discussed, may have had or will have an interest. Or what, are you going to have the two members of the public making the decisions on this oversight committee?
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, it seems to me that, if those boards are healthcare providers, in general, healthcare providers are not part of one of these health exchanges. They contract with the health exchange to help them move their data around, but they don't benefit from that in a financial way.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, if you were the user of one of these systems and on these boards, and how are you, if you were making decisions about how this system was governed, certainly you'd have a conflict because you're a user, and so you're governing somebody that you
have a or potentially have an account with. So what would be the penalty for violation of this conflict of interest policy?
Representative Huntley or Dr. Golden?
Dr. Golden.
Dr. Golden?
You get the tough ones.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm not entirely sure. I think we would have to look at the other state statutes around conflict of interest. This is a board that is appointed under Chapter 15. So to the degree that boards have requirements, and there's with this amendment would be an explicit requirement not to have a conflict of interest. I don't know off the top of my head what the penalty would be.
Everybody's turning to...
And Mr. Chair, I mean, I don't need to know this now, but certainly when it goes to the next committee, I would think those would be some of the things people might be interested in.
Okay, then looks like there's a Representative Kelly.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious of Dr. Golden, since this was brought up, just... Why the issue of pushing Minhai when Representative Huntley discussed it was considerably cheaper and there were no complaints about it? Why were we pushing Minhai?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Department of Health is not pushing any particular health information exchange. I think there are two separate issues. With regard to the bill, we are simply trying to put into place a structure that would allow as many health information exchange entities to exist as the market would bear, and to ensure that they communicate and share information between each other consistent with state law and privacy law. The other issue is there is federal funding. There is a $9.6 million cooperative agreement. That cooperative agreement had certain requirements in order to even apply for it. We did work collaboratively with both CHIC and Minhai to respond to that collaborative agreement. The only way we were able to respond affirmatively was in the way that we did, because otherwise we would not have been consistent with the cooperative agreement requirements.
One final thing.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley, I was just curious, as we listen to Mr. Frazier on possible amendments that might, it sounds like we have a differing of opinion on whether we have a fair agreement or not. Would you be entertaining those options?
Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, when this gets back to my committee, that's the Finance Committee, and we will look. There's some appropriations in this bill, and we would have the authority to change the fees as well. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, it looked like Mr. Frazier might have wanted to comment to the last, what the doctor just said. Is that right? Did I pick that up right?
Yes, thank you very much. CHIC is a small nonprofit and has built this health information exchange on a shoestring with our help. When they were told that they wouldn't get any funding out of this essentially $10 million in federal stimulus money, they were just shocked. They were never asked for a formal response to a request for funding. They were never told that any kind of funding would be dependent on answers to questions, and I think state government has to be very careful when handing out $10 million that you do it in an open, fair way. And what the community has come to understand, because Dr. Golden has publicly stated he will give that $6 million to Minhai, it becomes very clear to the public that the Department of Health has chosen a winner. They are funneling all the stimulus monies to that single service provider. So it sends a chill throughout the whole community that essentially the insurance industry, which is the main owners of Minhai, will be the beneficiaries of these all the stimulus dollars and will, have essentially been blessed by the state.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
Representative Hover.
One more quick question. Regarding this bill, will it be necessary for the Department of Health to come back to the legislature before this system could be hooked into the proposed nationwide health information network? Or will this bill pave the way for that to happen automatically?
Dr. Golden?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, what this bill is putting into place is that any health information exchange organization, whether it would be CHIC or MNHI or others that might be there, would have to build their systems in a way that is consistent with the standards and the requirements of the NHIN, the Nationwide Health Information Network. The actual exchange of information across that network would still require Minnesota healthcare providers, hospitals, and clinics to comply with Minnesota privacy requirements and consent requirements. And I think at this point, how that would be done is not entirely clear. So it's not that we would have to come back, but there would need to be consent built into the system for exchanging, and these entities would need to comply with that nationally.
So, Mr. Chair, just to be clear, it would not necessarily be necessary to come back to the legislature before these systems hook up nationwide.
Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, no. And I think as Mr. Frazier was mentioning, they have recently received in Duluth at CHIC a grant from the Social Security Administration to exchange information between hospitals and providers in the Duluth area with the Social Security Administration. That will be using the Nationwide Health Information Network standards to be able to exchange that information.
And if I might, were patients in Minnesota aware when they signed their consent forms that the Social Security Administration will have access to these the locators for their files?
Dr.
When they signed their consent forms?
Mr. Frazier?
What happens is when a patient applies for disability insurance in Social Security, they sign a document allowing the Social Security Administration to look at all their medical records because it is a medical disability determination. So the patient already would have had to have given written consent before the Social Security Administration could use the electronic systems or the current paper fax systems. So the consent doesn't change in this.
And Mr. Chair, just one.
Over.
So would then the Social Security Administration only be allowed to do inquiries of people in which they'd have that informed consent from?
Exactly. Okay. And since we log and audit every access in the system, and we have a very strong audit committee in the CHIC area that the hospital security people run, they will be paying particular attention to ensure that Social Security is doing the right thing.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, does an individual patient have access to the audit record about them?
Mr. Frazier?
Not at this time. They would have to request that through their provider, and then they could get access to it. But they don't have direct access on the web, for example. But
no, if I might, but they could say, I want to know who has looked at my records
yes.
through this system.
Yes.
And they would be able to receive that information.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 3279 as amended to government operations. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right, the next bill we have for consideration is House File 3469. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, this is a bill that was, an agreement has been reached. Representative Nelson had one on behalf of developers last year, which would have wiped out our Minnesota anti-SLAPP suit statute. It would have reduced to 60 days the time for an appeal from a local government decision and would have required a bond on appeal. We've now reached an agreement, and what happens is there will be no change to our slap suit statute. We will change the present, it's 6 years that they have the right, anybody has the right to appeal. We're changing it down to 180 days. And then Mr. Gehring has the exact language for regarding the bond. Mr. Gehring, can you state that? Or is it being handled?
Excuse me, Mr. Gehring. Madam Chair?
Representative Deskowski.
Could I just ask which bill we're on? I'm sorry.
Oh, it's 3469.
Thank you.
Mr. Gehring, could you do it?
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, there's actually a handwritten amendment being passed out that shows the new language, but I can read it just so it's clear.
Well, that's okay. What it does is it just states that there won't be a bond on this type of a thing for damages, et cetera, or surety. And so we've got an agreement on this. So it's I would move that amendment to the sketched out one. It doesn't have a name, but.
All right. Is there any discussion to the amendment or any questions about the amendment? Okay, and I will read the amendment. Representative Mallory moves to amend House File 3469 as follows. Page 1, delete lines 20 to 23 and insert, quote, subdivision 3, bond upon appeal. A party may not be ordered to post a surety bond or damages bond as a condition of an appeal under this section, close quote. And page 2, delete lines 1 to 9.
That's it.
Any discussion about the amendment? All those in?
Does it need a number? Does it need a letter or a number?
No.
It's oral.
Okay.
All those in favor of Representative Mullery's written out oral amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. All right, Representative Mullery, now that you have the bill in the shape that you'd like it.
Madam Chair, I described the whole agreement.
All right. Any discussion to the bill?
Is this bill going to local government?
Madam Chair, no, it goes to GovOps. It doesn't go to local government. It goes to GovOps. It's my understanding.
Okay. Local government division being a subdivision, though, of government operations.
Wait a second. No, this one doesn't go to local government. Mike didn't want to. He signed on to the bill.
Okay.
It's technically all within our division because it's just changed. It's just dealing with appeals, which is within our division.
So this would be referred to the General Register?
It goes to the General Register.
Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to testify in favor of or in opposition to this bill? Any other discussion? Okay, seeing no further discussion, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 3469 as orally amended be passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion carries. All right, the next bill up for consideration is House File 2600.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move that also.
All right, and Representative Mara, I see there is an amendment labeled A1.
Madam Chair, is A1 the one regarding Chapter 58?
Yes, 58A.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll remove that one.
All right. All right, and this bill is going to Commerce next?
Yes.
All right. Representative Mallory moves the A1 amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. No. This one has to go. This is the one that goes to state departments first, and then it goes back to Commerce.
State and local government?
Right.
All right.
Whatever they call Pawlowski's committee.
Okay, so you're moving the bill to state and local government, and now you're moving amendment.
Government Operations, Technology, and Reform.
See, I thought it said government.
All right. Please explain your amendment, Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, it's a very technical amendment, and Ms. Brown from the agency can explain how changes that were required by the federal government in the SAFE Act affected our Chapter 58, and so those amendments are technical, and she can do a much better job of explaining those.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Robin Brown. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I'm in charge of the licensing of mortgage originator companies. And under the proposed Federal SAFE Act, which is a federal mandate, it requires us to license individual mortgage loan originators. The amendment before you is to incorporate some changes into Chapter 58, which are the result of the SAFE Act regulations that we proposed in Chapter 58A. Essentially, it just changes some of the financial responsibility requirements to a bond requirement. Takes out some of the language that is no longer relevant as a result of the federal mandates that are coming down. And it imposes some fees as a result of having to license the individual loan originators. Sets forth some terms of the license, changing them from a biannual license renewal to an annual renewal. And essentially, that's about it. There is an assessment provision that's at the end of the bill. As a result of having to comply with this federal mandate, we have to join a national licensing system, and the technology fee that all the individual states have to pay is going to, we're proposing to be collecting it through an assessment on the individual mortgage originator companies.
All right, are there any questions? Ms. Scott, Representative Scott.
That's okay, thank you, Madam Chair. What happens if we don't comply?
Madam Chair, and actually, I got a call about that in September, and because my foreclosure worked nationally, I know the banking commissioner in Massachusetts, and he's head of the National Banking Commissioners on this issue. They worked with Congress and got it passed. They can step, in fact, he says, you know, we're about ready to do something. They can step in and take over our licensing system. So if we don't comply, so it's a big threat. We have to comply, and we have to use their language, everything like that. And so we're under a definite gun.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mulway, how much money would the state save if they took over the licensing system instead of us?
Madam Chair and Representative Truskowski, I imagine that they would charge for whatever cost they ran up, and I'm sure that the local, I know that when I've talked to mortgage brokers, they definitely don't want the feds coming in. They're happy with the setup that we have here with the Commerce Department.
All right. Any further discussion? Yeah. Okay. Is there any last? No? No. Okay. Right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in favor of or in opposition to the bill? All right. Any other questions or discussion? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Mallory renews his motion that House File 2600, as amended by Amendment Marked A1, be passed and referred to local state and local government operations, government technology, and reform.
Government operations.
Wait, yeah, whatever. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Was that sufficient legal lawyer talk?
Oh, whatever.
Whatever.
No, that's someone tired and hungry. Who needs a timeout? All right, our motion passes.
Put the vice chair in a corner.
Well, we can keep this out here. Also, why don't we just do the language?
Okay.
All right, the next bill we have for consideration is House File 2668.
Mr. Chair, you know, you carry an awful lot of bills for a chairman.
Madam Chair, I'll move. I think we're working off 2668, and we want to move the delete all, which is the DE1 amendment. And Madam Chair, this is a, when it came forward, it was broken down into 2985, 2816, 2668, and 2829, which was carried by Representatives Champion, me, Hayden, and Clark. And the agreement was that we would push them all into a delete all based upon what the parties could agree on, and we now have the DE1, and I believe there's another, there's a couple
oral amendments.
There's oral amendments to this. The agreements have been going on during the day.
And
Mr. Elwood, could you explain?
Mr. Chair, could you again say which bills, this, are there bills that we can cross off?
Yes, 2985, Representative Clark, 2816, Representative Hayden, 2668, mine, and Representative Champions, 2829. Those are all
yours. It's yours.
No, we're not crossing off the 20. She asked what was in this. So,
well, Mr. Chair, are we still going to hear all four of these bills after your bill?
No. Everything is rolled into this as part of the agreement between the landlords and tenants' representatives. And they've agreed on some oral amendments since the TE1 was drafted. And Mr. Elwood is going to explain those oral amendments, and Mr. Horner is right here. Oh, are you going to do it? Okay. Do you want to come up?
Okay.
Representative Mueller, do you want your oral amendments to be incorporated into the DE1?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you explain those oral amendments?
He will state the amendments first before explaining them.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. The first amendment to the amendment would be on lines 1.21 through 2.3, which we would be striking. We are working on this particular provision. In concept, we are both in agreement that the a motion for expungement should be made or can be made at the same time that the eviction case was heard immediately following in the same proceeding. There are some negotiations that still need to go on, and in the effort of good faith for both of us, so that neither of us has any advantages right now, we're just going to strike the language and continue to work on this as we move forward. But the basic concept is agreed to, that the motion for expungement for judicial efficiency and also for to make sure that the landlord has an opportunity to appear at and make statements at the in opposition to or in support of the expungement at the same time the eviction case is heard makes sense to both sides. So in the interest of fairness, we'd ask for you to approve this amendment as we move forward. The second one, it's very technical. There are actually a couple on page 2, line 6, after or, delete that and insert how, which simply makes it consistent with the provision right above it.
Would you repeat this? So 2.6.
2.6, after the word or,
mm-hmm.
Delete that and insert how. And so that's, as if you read the entire paragraph, it says that a written ruling has to be made on the expungement motion indicating how the case satisfied the statutory requirements for expungement, or conversely, if it's denied, how they fail to satisfy. So it's just making it consistent. And one final very, it's a typographical error you need to correct on line 3.34. Before the word tenant, delete perspective and insert prospective. And Madam Chair, if I may.
With that last one, perspective, prospective. Yeah. Got it.
And just a second before we continue, I think it would be appropriate. I'm sorry that the rest of the committee isn't here because I want folks to know that this is going to be Jack Horner's last appearance before your committee. He is retiring. And I just want to acknowledge the landlords and not only Jack but Todd's really good faith efforts to work with us this session. We've got a very good framework for a deal here. It went very quickly. They've been very, very collegial. But over the 12 years that I've been here, Jack, I can say, even though he's bested me, my batting average with Jack is very, very low. But despite that, I have the utmost respect for him. He's always been a gentleman, always acted collegially. He's very effective. And I think I'm sure everybody will miss him. I will miss him. So I just want to acknowledge that this will be his last appearance before the committee and just say thanks, Jack, for great work here at the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Any other discussion to the amendment?
Well, this is it.
Hearing none, the D. Oh, all right. How do I make a technical? Okay. Staff has brought to my attention that line 2.4 needs a technical correction, deleting E and inserting C, C as in cat. Which makes sense since we took out C and D. All right.
Madam Chair, just one quick thing. I also want to thank Jack Horner and Ron Elwood for really working. I've been here a long time, and this is the best I've ever seen them work together, so I think it's
They play well together.
Should thank them because we've achieved some important things this year, and it's because they were able to work well together. Thank you.
Let's not forget Todd and Michael.
Yeah, mutual hug.
Well, I am new here, Representative Mullery, but I've already noticed that when the stakeholders get together and really work it out and do some compromising, things really move well. And the whole state of Minnesota benefits. So the DE1 amendment with the oral clarifications that have been stated is in front of us. Is there any other discussion to the amendment? Mr. Elwood.
Well, excuse me, I just want to be clear that on many of these provisions, we are in a total agreement on language. I just want to state for the record that we are still kind of working on some tweaks, but the framework is here, and we just appreciate the committee's allowing us to move forward and continue to dot the I's and cross the T's, but I just want to make it clear that we're still.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, just for the record, Todd Lilgenquist, Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I would just like to echo what Ron said. We'll continue to work, and we've been negotiating in good faith, and we'll continue to do so, and hopefully have a good work product at the end.
Excellent. Your efforts are appreciated. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 266, the DE1 amendment. All in favor of Representative...
Goes to the general register.
The DE1 amendment as amended is before us. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Great. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Any other discussion or questions? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 2668... as amended, be passed and referred
General Register.
To the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. The next bill we have for consideration is House File 3098, Representative Blocker. Yes.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to state well that 2707 and 2619 will be taken up on Wednesday in our committee. The county attorneys are still working on the exact language.
Okay, 2707 and which is the
2619.
Other? And 2619.
She said 2619.
Okay. House Files 2707 and 2619 are laid over. All right. Would someone like to move, Representative?
It's not taken up.
They're just well, then they're removed from the agenda. That was easy. Would someone like to move Representative Loeffler's bill to get it for the committee? Representative Mullery has moved House File 3098. We have the bill before us. All right, Representative Loeffler, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3098 looks like it's more than it is. And so let me just say that it's primarily a recodification. And so there's lots of new language, but there's not new policy. This is the kind of proposal that all of us have been looking for all session. A no-cost proposal that improves trauma care, better protects privacy, and helps save lives. I think that's kind of a nice combination. It will provide better protection of data privacy for the patients of small rural hospitals, and it continues implementation of the statewide trauma system by adopting two new level of trauma care designations that the federal government has created, which is for pediatric trauma care, and that's pediatric trauma levels 1 and 2. It updates and recodifies existing laws. There's no new data and no new reports requested. It provides for quality improvement in our ever-growing and more complicated emergency trauma system. For those of you who don't serve on the health committee, trauma is defined as sort of train wreck emergency care. This is not you fall down and break your leg. This is like you break lots of things in a major accident or in an explosion or in a fire. And so that's what we use to refer to trauma. It's not your basic ambulance run. This is more typically a person who in rural Minnesota might be taken to by ambulance to a local hospital to be stabilized while the air helicopter comes in from one of the level one trauma centers and swoops them through the air to someplace that can do much more comprehensive care for those kind of catastrophic illnesses and injuries. And with me, I have Tim Held from the trauma unit of the Department of Health and Jim Golden, who works with our data and information systems there, to answer specific questions.
Representative Loeffler, excuse me, before your testifiers begin, Representative Mahoney had a question.
Well, this might be for staff or for the one of the chairs. What parts of this is all health department stuff? What part of this bill pertains to our committee? If you could be specific.
Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and Representative Mullery, because it has to do with the use of and collection of health data.
Did you call me Representative Mullery?
I'm sorry. Excuse me. Representative Mahoney, I did not mean to make that distinction while I was looking at the notes on the bill.
I know he's handsome, but I've always, you know, had a better opinion of myself.
Actually, I was trying to avoid saying Mr. Chair, recognizing that while the chair of the committee is still sitting in front of me, it's Representative Jackson who's chairing the committee. Because this deals with health data and the collection of it, and that it tends to be data collection an issue before this committee, that's why it was recommended to come here.
So Representative Loeffler, essentially then Section 5, the trauma registry section?
Madam Chair, that and the protection of the information in Section 4 dealing with the classification of data used to designate trauma hospitals. And that's to make sure that when a small hospital applies for a trauma designation, even though all the information about the patient has been removed, if you happen to live in that area and there's only been one explosion in the last 10 years, just knowing that that's what it was about might let you know who it was. And so this will give it a private classification so that that information is not made available to others.
All right. You may identify yourself for the committee and welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, Jim Golden, Director of Health Policy at the Department of Health. Specifically, the lines 3.1 through 3.4 are a change in state statute. Currently, the designation process reports are public information. We are suggesting that these be changed to private data on individuals and non-public on non-individuals. This is to ensure that any blinded data of patients that are in the reports do not inadvertently identify trauma patients. And then specifically on line 331 through 332, data not on individuals are non-public. That is, hospital data in the trauma registry is currently public. We are suggesting that that be made non-public, specifically so people can't get information about hospitals and for those hospitals that have very few trauma cases inadvertently identify patients. Those would be the only changes. The rest of Section 5 is a recodification, Madam Chair.
Any questions for this witness? You have another witness, Representative Laufer?
Madam Chair, I do not, but there may be others in the audience who wish to speak or will answer questions.
All right. Is there anyone here who wishes to testify? Please come forward. Welcome back, Ms. Braze. Would you please identify yourself again?
Thank you. 12 Braze, Citizens Council on Healthcare. Just a minute. For that. Twyla Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare, and I think probably just like the overall thing to say about this bill is that there's a lot of surveillance systems already in the state of Minnesota, and they don't have individual consent for it. And one of the things that you're going to be receiving is this right here, which talks about Minnesotans being under surveillance and gives just a snapshot, just a few of the healthcare systems in which individuals are having their names and information collected without their consent. And although there is has been a trauma registry, this is really taking it into a centralized format because there's been three data systems before. And essentially what we're trying to say is we don't want the surveillance systems to grow. We don't want them to get more developed within the state of Minnesota. What we really want is to give people the right of consent over having their private information kept on a database at the government level for uses like research, etc. There is in the 2010 report from the Minnesota Department of Health a plan or a request, I'm not sure how you want to call it, for a research person to conduct research using the data. These are individuals. This is a government data system. And I'd like to point out that the definition for trauma, major trauma, is in one of the sheets of paper that's being passed out as well. And you can see that it's broad when it talks about impairment of cognitive and mental abilities, impairment of physical functioning, or disturbance of behavioral and emotional functioning. And indeed, perhaps today they could decide to define that very limited. But the fact of the matter is those terms are not defined, which means that they could define it as broadly as they wish. And I point out in the handout as well that the plan is to collect outcomes data as well, and there's no limit on how long they could be collecting the outcomes data. How long is an outcome? 2 years later, 10 years later, I have no idea. But there's no limit. So if there's no limit, there's the possibility to actually expand it. I also passed out for you this, which I realize is in draft, but it came from one of their reports, which just shows you the degree of information that's being collected on individuals without their consent. And I think it's important to just understand that people do not know that all these data systems exist. And what we do not want is for the data systems to grow. What we would like to see is for the data systems to be limited to shrink as opposed to growing or being further codified and strengthened within the state of Minnesota. So thank you for your time, and that's my testimony.
Thank you. Any questions for this witness?
Oh, Madam Chair, may I also say, because I clearly forgot to say, what we really want is consent, informed individual consent.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Any other discussion? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this might be for Representative Loeffler. I don't really understand, why do we need this? We're building all kinds of collection systems with all kinds of different bills today, and here's yet one more. That's another mandate to the healthcare industry. It's going to increase costs. It's going to increase the size and scope of government. Why are we doing this?
Madam Chair, I'm Tim Held, and I'm the program manager for the state trauma system. And so, Representative, I think that's a fair, it's a good question. The primary use of the trauma registry is for quality improvement for trauma care at the local level and at the regional level and at the state level. Let me give you an example, and then I'll be brief. It's a true story. A 12-year-old girl falls from a monkey bars in rural Minnesota, falls down, hits her stomach, has abdominal pain for some time. They decide to bring her into the hospital because she doesn't seem to be getting better. She sits at a local rural hospital for an extended period of time. They observe her. Her vital signs are fine, but the pain doesn't go away. And so after a long period of time, with really a limited assessment and understanding of mechanism of injury and sort of injuries that can happen internally, they decide that they're going to send her to another hospital because they can't care for her. There's time involved in moving her in a transfer to one hospital. When she finally gets to the second hospital, they realize then that they really are not equipped to care for a pediatric patient. And so they arrange for another transfer, so she continues to wait. Time goes by, need to bring in an ambulance service again to transfer her. They bring her to a third hospital. The third hospital accepts the transfer. They get there and they begin to observe her, and under their care, she begins to deteriorate, and her vital signs begin to crash. And anybody that understands how pediatric patients are when they're injured, they usually maintain their vital signs quite well until when they drop, you're really at the end of the game with children. So they did recognize that the vital signs were dropping. They were not equipped to care for her. Set up another transfer, fly her to a level one trauma center, at which point, as they were moving her into the surgery suite, she died. And she died from a moderate spleen rupture, which is easily cared for. So in terms of measuring the quality of care and what happens in the system of care, both in the pre-hospital and the assessment at the hospital, and moving them and making the right decisions where the patient needs to go to for that definitive surgical care, all of that is involved in the quality improvement use of the data. The data will also look at pre-hospital response times. How long does it take for ambulance services to get to these patients? How long are they on the scene? Should they be? Are they using the proper use of helicopter services? A big expense to the healthcare system. And are they just flying people, or are they appropriately using helicopter resources or not? Are they doing proper diagnostic tests on patients? One of the things the trauma system and these rural trauma hospitals that are becoming designated hospitals are doing now is shortening their time with those patients. They make those rapid decisions. Do they stay or don't they? And they make those very purposeful decisions, and they quickly move them to definitive care in one transfer. The typical practice prior to the establishment of the trauma system has been often to do a series of diagnostic testing, which is not necessary, because even if the diagnostic testing reveals something, the hospital is not equipped to care for that patient. They're not the definitive stop. And so, again, we're using medical resources and doing a lot of duplicative tests prior to moving them on just to be repeated again, and there's a delay in the patient care. So these are the sort of examples at the quality improvement that's trying to be done with the data. In terms of the use of the patient identifiable data, the purpose of that is to be able to link these different data bases all to one event. So for instance, on that child I just talked about, there's a medical record that was created on that patient from the original ambulance service. They transported him to the local hospital. At that local hospital, there's a medical record that's formed on that girl. And then they transfer her, so now the transferring ambulance fills out a medical record of their care and the sorts of things they have, the vital signs and those things for the girl. Same thing happens to the next hospital. They create a patient record. The helicopter creates a patient record. The definitive care hospital creates a patient record. So if these five cases or six records can't be linked together into one event, we can't begin to start to understand what's happening with trauma care. We can't link them into one event. They look like all like six different events, and there's no way to be able to tie them into a system of care. And where were the breaks? Where were the breakdowns in the care along the way that we can improve? So that's the use of those data, is just to be able to link those records across. Otherwise, it's just the local performance improvement and being able to describe injury in an aggregate way and be, to you and to the public and everybody else, what is the nature of injury, what's happening with injuries, serious injuries in Minnesota.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that as an education piece, because shows the importance of having this information, which I can appreciate. But I guess going back to Ms. Braze's suggestion of consent, I would offer the A1 amendment, and because I believe that all of those things could happen, and we'd be able to explain that to the individual or the parent at that time, why the importance of consent, and I believe everything could move as well through that. So I would offer that A1 amendment.
All right. Representative Kelly moves the A1 amendment. Anything else you'd like to state about this? Mahoney. Representative Mahoney.
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, do you support this amendment?
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, not as it's been described. I haven't seen the language yet.
I don't know.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Representative Holbert.
Oh, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, I just have a question. If you look at page 3, line 21, why do you have that broad latitude? I mean, the commissioner could require names. The commissioner could, I mean, you know, you talk about the de-identified but listing of the five items as being necessary to hook up the same incident. And then you have the Mack truck exception in 6 that the commissioner can decide whatever else. So I'm just concerned about that there really is no constraint on the information being requested because of the latitude given to the commissioner in that section. And so I think consent becomes even more important.
Mr. Helton.
Madam Chair and Representative, this is existing language as we have now, so it's just recodified. It's not new authorities at all. And actually, the page that Ms. Brace showed you is lists the data that's being collected, and that is done through a collective, broad public and stakeholder groups that have come to consensus on identifying that this is the data that we need in order to do it. Again, we are interested in just the major trauma. That's our interest. We don't want to go beyond that, and so this is just consistent with what we currently have.
And Madam Chair, I'm sorry. And then if you go down to line 25 on that same page, is that section of law, section 14.125, governing rules, is that where you actually have to present it to the public?
Dr. Golden.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, no, it is not. Right now, there are rules for the trauma registry. They are part of the traumatic brain injury rules, and they are in another part. The authority for them is in another part of statute. So what this line is doing is saying that even though we are writing this new section, this is a requirement that says when you have rule authority, you must promulgate rules within 18 months. The trauma system already has rules in place, so simply rearranging where it is in statute doesn't re-trigger the requirement to do it within 18 months because we have already done it. It has nothing to do with the hearing that would be required in front of an ALJ.
All right, thank you. All right, any further discussion? We have an amendment before us. All right, all in favor of Representative Kelly's A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Oppose no?
No.
Motion fails. Back to the bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Holberg.
I'm sorry. Is the language on page 2, lines 3 through 5, does that exempt the commissioner from that public process?
Dr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, no, that is just deleting expired language. The commissioner was required to do a report to the legislature with regard to the trauma system. That report has been delivered to the legislature.
I'm looking at lines 3 through 5. Not the stricken language, but is that section of law exempting the public process for rulemaking under this program?
Dr. Golden.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, no, this is a section that is unrelated to the trauma registry. This is what the requirements are to be designated as a level 1 through 4 trauma center. So these are what requirements does a hospital have to satisfy to be either a level 1, 2, 3, or 4. This does not exempt the commissioner from any of the rule requirements or the public hearing requirements associated with the trauma registry.
But
Representative
Madam Chair and Dr. Golden, the commissioner is exempt from the standards around identifying trauma hospitals from the standard rulemaking part, right? So in other words, everything in the page 1 up to 2.2. I mean, it says right here that the commissioner of health is exempt from chapter 14. I'm assuming that's the public process around rulemaking.
Dr. Golden.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, that is correct. That section exempts the commissioner from the standard rulemaking process for determining the criteria for hospital designation.
All right, thank you.
All right, members, we have now been in committee for a full 3 hours, and I would like Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 3098 be passed and referred to as amended. Oh, yeah. No, it wasn't amended. It's all right. That House File 3098 be passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oppose no.
No.
And the motion carries. All right, we have to do one quick thing. Representative Mullery moves to reconsider House File 1746 in that we acted on the wrong engrossment. So we have the correct engrossment. Oh. All right. Representative Mullery moves to reconsider House File 1746. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed no. Motion passes. We have 1746, the first engrossment in front of us. We did. We do.
this is what we get.
All right.
It's in the package.
Apparently, members, what we actually discussed and what was in front of us was correct, but the motion was wrong. I will entertain a motion to pass House File 1746 and we refer it to the General Register. Discussion?
But, Madam Chair, I'm not even seeing 1746 on the agenda, but I've also scribbled a whole lot on it. So.
Apparently, we heard it last week.
Inflatable amusement.
Oh. Oh.
Bigham's bouncy toy.
Bigham, check out of the state
first.
Oh, is that the mouse?
Well, we didn't move here.
It did have that.
The motion just didn't.
He laid it over?
It was.
Representative Scott.
Yeah, it was laid over.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. Bigham had a different bill.
Apparently, our collective memory is that it passed.
Okay.
All right.
So
there was the wrong version.
We passed the wrong version.
It was supposed to be the first engrossment. We were working on the original as it was introduced.
That's right.
For
VWI.
And you use somewhere in this file.
iPhone. All right, well, push is going to come to shove here. All those in favor of the motion to pass House File 1746 and refer it to the General Register, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
First
reading. Do we have to bring up first motion or are we fine now?
What?
No, you shouldn't have. Good. Right?
Meeting's adjourned.